It is a buried feast, one might say, the feast of all the Athenite fathers. The Church closed the great event of the resurrection the day before yesterday with the Feast of All Saints. Then Christ goes out to choose his disciples and apostles, through whom he will hand on the truths that flow from the resurrection of Christ and the ways of man's salvation. And I say further, above all, that the Church is reminding us of what happened on the Holy Mountain with the fathers there. Those of you who came to church today, take note. The two brothers, Simon and Andrew, James and John, followed him without any discussion and without any contract, as we might put it. Come after me, and I will make you fishers of men. They leave everything and follow, he goes on. Come after me, James and John, and I will make you fishers of men. They leave the fishing boat and their father, and they follow. I ask this weighty event, which shows how many people followed without a single promise given, does it convict us at all? For we today are not dealing with a stranger who passes along the shore and gathers people. We are dealing with one who is known, whom we know, who was revealed to us, who made us a promise, who worked miracles, and still works miracles. We have a stance to take toward this event. We are willing to follow him, and not, of course, into the unknown, as those men followed him, but into the known, indeed into what is thoroughly known. We cannot say today, I do not know what happens beyond the grave, because we have knowledge of what happens beyond the grave from the very one who was there, who came and went back again, and who awaits us. These are reasonable considerations, and the purpose of the Church, which year by year brings these events onto the stage, and insists on them, and repeats them, and will go on repeating them until the end of the ages, is to remind man of the position he must take toward Christ. You know the pursuits of the world today, how it thinks and how it follows. One creature wags its tail, and they follow, someone else beckons, and they follow, he promises them this, and they follow, he promises something else abroad, and they follow. He promises worldly successes, and man follows, even if afterward rivers of tears follow upon the failure. But Christ, man does not follow. He does not want him, does not want to listen to him. Man today does not like his teaching. He does not like anything of Christ. He wants the affairs of the world, promises that do not console, do not relieve, do not guarantee anything. And yet man follows them. Where is man's reason? Where is this man today who claims he has advanced so far? Man, even though he reached the moon, since he has not landed upon these basic matters, has failed for the present. And you see what is happening out there. Society has failed. Society is shipwrecked. It is one entire shipwreck, the family, the individual, and society. Only a few remain at their posts, at the helm and at the mast. The rest have been shipwrecked, as you know very well from the breakdown of the family and of society more broadly. We believe that a society's happiness is found in material things. Look at the Scandinavian countries, which have, in proportion, far more comforts than we do, and yet they are an underworld. You cannot even greet them, whatever the occasion when you see them, you cannot so much as greet them. You wonder whether you should even greet them. Look at the West. I know what you want. Just look what the human person lacks is grace. It is Christ. It is a return to the Church. Unless this happens, the human person will remain unfulfilled. No matter what material success one achieves, no matter how far one advances or how much one saves and sets aside, if Christ is not within, there will always be an emptiness inside, and one may go so far as suicide. And you see that suicide is not something that seizes those who have nothing, who had nothing to occupy them, but also those who have plenty. They blow their brains out in advance because everything lies not in matter, but in the spirit. So Christ promised these men nothing, and they followed him. To us he promises the kingdom of heaven and eternal life, and we do not follow him. What is the difference between us and them? Beyond this reproach, both indirect and direct, that flows from the conduct of those first men, there is for us also that second part I mentioned to you, the matter of the Athenite fathers. I do not know whether it has ever occupied you. It is a matter, as I told you at the beginning, that is buried. Someone must bring it to light to give an opportunity to those who are willing to pay attention. We Greeks above all, who know neither the history of our nation and our people, nor the history of our church and our saints, naturally do not know about this matter either. When we say the Holy Mountain and the Athenite Fathers, it is something that has to do more with the Theotokos and less with Christ. Not, of course, that Christ does not save there, or that they do not call upon him, but with regard to the initiative, if I accept Christ as the one at the head at Gennesaret, calling and being followed, here we accept as the head the Most Holy Theotokos, who calls and is followed. Have you ever been there yourselves? Those of you men who have gone will have seen for themselves the things I am describing, and will have understood how rightly the Church has acted in bringing all these men to light so that people might imitate them. It is true, and it is sad, that most of us have never visited these holy places, these places trodden by the Most Holy Theotokos. For if anyone does happen to get there, he will see that out of every 100 who enter the mountain, 98 are foreigners. Only 1 or 2% are our own people who go to the mountain to venerate. The foreigners, of course, do not go to venerate. They go from an archaeological angle, from a scientific angle, for the sake of study, or to steal certain things. There are many things there for them to carry off, whether documents or hidden writings or various icons, to profit from them, and many orthodox things we now receive from the West, and not from the mountain. Much has been written, and much is still being written. Every year someone comes along willing to spend a little paper, and a little ink, and a little of his own light, to bring something to light. So this evening I thought, since I was called unexpectedly to speak here this Sunday, for this is the fifth day I have been speaking here, that I would mention one small event out of the whole matter of the mountain. People want to remain forever, and they pursue this in various ways, as you yourselves know, and you will have noticed how hard they labor to give their name a chance to be immortalized, as we might say, to be inscribed on a slab, to be inscribed on a monument. People, he says, want to tie their names to material things in the conviction that this way they will last forever. No one makes supplication to Philip, nor to Alexander with his Alexandrupolis, none at all, but there came times when people sought out prayers and supplications and made entreaties to men who had bound themselves not to material things. Indeed, they abandoned material things altogether and bound themselves to God. Whoever receives the seal of Christ in this world remains in eternity, himself eternal, but those who choose to bind themselves to the world without Jesus will be blotted out, will die, and will be buried. The men who abandoned the world, like Simon, Peter, James, John, and all of them, remained in eternity. We call upon them. They have no need of us. We have need of them. It is true that the people of that age, like people today, pity those who abandon the so-called good things of this world, its interests, its pleasures, its worldly reputations, and so on. And who follow Jesus, they consider them mad, backward, inconsistent, ridiculous. Yet these are the wise ones, for the man who stores up something that can remain in eternity, he is the wise one. Whatever a non-Christian stores up, he stores up for the flesh, and so it will be as temporary as the flesh itself. For the final destiny of the flesh is, you are dust, and to dust you shall return. These people then cannot be misunderstood. For they clung to Christ, they clung to the Theotokos. Since the subject is the Athenite Fathers, I would like to convey to you the original thought of how and when the mountain came to be. The mountain was chosen by the Most Holy Theotokos. Just as Jerusalem is the place of Christ, the place trodden by Christ, so this is the place trodden by the Most Holy Theotokos. And just as we could speak of Christ around Jerusalem, so too we can speak of his mother around the Holy Mountain. Her first desire concerning the Holy Mountain, that from the wilderness it then was it should become habitable, and become not merely equal to the seven wonders, but something greater than what it has become today, this she first revealed to St. Peter the Athenite while he was in prison. There she revealed to him specifically the following, I will read it to you in paraphrase, so that you may understand it, though I also have it in the original text. There is a mountain in Greece most beautiful, and at the same time very great, sloping toward the south, and it stretches far out into the sea. I myself will fight alongside them all the days of their life. I will be their helper, so that together we may fight against the enemies we have in common. And I will become for them an invincible helper. I will teach them the things they ought to do, and I will explain to them again the things they ought not to do. I will be for them a provider, a physician, and a nourisher, caring both for the nourishment and the healing of their bodies and their souls. And I will not let the soul fall away from goodness and virtue. And all this I will do for them while they are still alive, but after their death, I will commend to my Son and my God those who have ended their lives on this mountain in a manner pleasing to God and in repentance, and I will ask my Son to grant them the perfect and complete forgiveness of their sins. This is a promise that was given by the Most Holy Theotokos. It is a promise of the Theotokos to all those people who would be willing to leave something of this world behind and cross over into that other one. This institution, as you know, is misunderstood by many because Satan is a skilled craftsman, and today we see over and over again how fiercely monasticism is attacked. Our young people find nothing of substance to fill their lives, and that is why they go wild, and you see the way they let it show on the outside. It shows how they present themselves on the outside and how they think and act on the inside. If it were revealed to these people, to these children of theirs, that there is a valiant young man named Christ who holds out something worth having, many of them would follow him, however hard the road may seem. Today, the enemy of monasticism is the Christians, above all, and even the monks themselves. Those outside cannot do as much harm as the so-called Christians who belong first and foremost to organizations and have never grasped the spirit, the true, the divine, the patristic spirit of revelation, and who strive through their own works to supposedly satisfy God and put their own souls at ease. This is the greatest enemy of monasticism. As I was saying this morning in church, where I was given the chance, I said this: whatever Christianity possesses, it possesses from the monastery, from the monasteries, from the monks. No professor, no philosopher, no dignitary has contributed a single signed line to what the Church has. Everything comes from the holy monasteries. Take the Parakletiki, take the Triodion, take the Octoekios, take whatever you like. Take the mysteries, take the services, take whatever you like. They are all from the monasteries. So if we ever wanted to close this digression, we have all been caught up in it, and today there is a systematic struggle underway, because Satan knows that the monk says no to him, unlike us who say yes to him. Saint Ephraim the Syrian, speaking of the fellowship of the monks, says this: as a camp of holy angels, so is a multitude of monks gathered together. As if you were looking, he says, at a host of holy angels, so, he says, you should look upon the monks as well. Their minds are continually turned toward God, for no matter how poor a monk he may be, no matter how much he may have failed in his calling and in his struggle, he is always better than I am. A layman who lives amid so much noise and so many cares, with my attention scattered in every direction, for in order to discover what lies in the depths of his soul, a person needs hesychiah, inner stillness. The soul may be compared to a lake. You will see that even the slightest breath of wind disturbs the surface of the water and prevents you from looking into the depths of the lake to see what is there. Out here there is so much noise, so much of the devil, and so many demands that a person is never allowed to become calm, to find himself, and to see what he truly is. This is why Saint Basil the Great, speaking about these things, says, hesychia, inner stillness, is the beginning of the purification of the soul. Unless you become calm and enter into stillness, it is impossible to see what is happening beneath the surface. Go to a lake one day when there is no wind at all and the surface is calm. You will see milk cartons, wreaths, stones, and every kind of filth lying at the bottom, things you would otherwise be unable to see. You can never see clearly if there is even the faintest breath of wind. You cannot see it. This is what they achieve, things which we do not achieve. Satan catches hold of us, them he does not catch, for they flee from him, because they see him, they know him, they perceive him. We, here where we are, do not perceive him. This is the difference between the one and the other. And St. Gregory of Nyssa says this, a soul at stillness, set free from outward things, perceives more precisely its own goods and its own ills. When the soul finds stillness, he says, and is freed from the noises, from the cares, from the pleasures, from the interests, and from the wickedness of this world, then, he says, a person can examine himself more precisely down to the details why a good or why an evil befalls him. And this is true because a person in the midst of the noise of this world cannot possibly manage to find himself and cleanse himself as Christ desires. Every person who withdraws from this world makes it easier on the one hand for others to take notice of him. For he is a brave one. It is not easy to say no to your own flesh, where the flesh promises you no such things. It is not easy to deny your own self-interest, where you will have to give up everything. It is not easy to deny your own ego, where you must kneel down and say bless even to the most corrupt superior over you. This triptych of continence, of non-possession, and of obedience is the essential thing that every person needs in order to be sanctified. And nonetheless, from kings down to the lowliest servant, they abandoned everything and came to the holy mountain, there where before there were wild beasts, there where there were dragons and serpents. And so, in a certain sense, even under compulsion, a person lives somewhat far from certain basic sins that drive away the grace of God. For the flesh is the bottomless enemy of the human soul. We feed it and we coddle it, but we do nothing else than feed the bottomless one and coddle the bottomless enemy of our own soul. For although this union of soul and body is blessed, the soul was given first place in the hierarchy, while the flesh, the body, was placed second. Yet through our carelessness we have given first place to the flesh and put the soul second. We have taken her from being mistress and made her a slave. This, of course, is our own doing, and for this we shall be condemned. The one who created them in this order is not to blame. In any case, these places, as I was saying, offer no opportunity for fleshly and worldly things which hinder a person from being saved. Those who departed gained everything. Suppose Lot had not left Sodom and Gomorrah, what would have happened? He would have been burned, and so it shall be. His wife, who wanted to look back and see what was happening to the buildings, became a pillar of salt. Blessed is the person who succeeds in leaving something of this world behind, as people do today, both those who follow the gospel and those who go to the holy mountain. If you were to ask about the founders of the monasteries there on the holy mountain, you would find that most of them were emperors and rulers. They not only sent money to establish those foundations and buildings, which are entire towns, but also came themselves and laid aside their imperial robes of purple. And they became mule drivers and herdsmen, hauling provisions with the mule, grazing the animals, the sheep, the goats, and so on, because they saw the vanity of this world. A few days ago we celebrated the Feast of All Saints, and I do not know whether you heard when I was speaking about All Saints that I said one serious contributor to the establishing of this feast is also the Empress Theophano, the wife of Leo the Wise, who, when she made up her bed to sleep upon it and found the bed too comfortable, would sleep on the floor instead. She understood that all the things of this world, the comforts and the pleasures, do nothing at all to help a person towards salvation, because man is a great beast, and if he is not watched over, he will be lost because of this world. Kings, then, have built those places, patriarchs, distinguished people, abandoned everything, and came and became monks. When I went to the mountain 3 years ago, I met a hunched man loaded down with many things right in front of me, and I thought it was some kind of goblin. I thought it was Satan, the way he was hunched over, staring at the ground and so heavily loaded. It brought to mind that story Macarius the Egyptian tells, how he once met Satan loaded down with all sorts of things, but when I got to the monastery, I asked, has anyone just left here from the monastery? Yes, he says, an elder left. What sort of elder is he? Ah, let me tell you, he is English. He came here to Greece 15 years ago. This man came as a tourist, as we were saying, to see the mountain. When he saw that things here were not as he had understood them from afar and through his learning, he stayed. He was a mature man with 7 diplomas when he came to the mountain at 62 years of age. Now he is 77 and has been here for 15 years. And what does he do now? He carries food to the ascetics, and he goes to the monasteries that have a large crate to be transported. In this way he serves the cause of the holy mountain. For 1500 years, since the 4th or 5th century, monks have lived on the holy mountain. Ever since then, the all-holy Theotokos has been sending her own people to that place, people for whom she toiled so much, and who in turn left behind teachings for us. Among other things, I have gathered here a few sayings from these holy men. You will see that all of these who went there had a death that was, above all, not an honorable one. So it was with all the people of God, beginning with Christ himself, who had a death that was not honorable but dishonorable by the cross. John the Forerunner did not have a good end. They sent for his head, just as John Chrysostom died in exile at Caucasus in Armenia. Not all who served Christ, his apostles. Some were crucified upside down. Some were sawn apart. Some were cut into 1,000 pieces. This shows that they had grasped the matter and were indifferent toward this present age, caring instead for the age to come, for the sake of honor and for the sake of what it reveals. I conveyed to you a few things from today's Synaxarion of these Athenite fathers. To keep good order, we begin from St. Athanasius the Athenite, who is the founder of the monastery of the Great Lavra, as it is called, an entire city in itself. This is, in a sense, the first monastery. St. Athanasius appears as its guide and teacher, and he was counted worthy to mark out his own tomb beforehand. A great cypress tree grows from his tomb. Some wanted to open his tomb, and it sent out fire. He did not allow his tomb to be opened, and it remains to this day inside the Catholicon of the Holy Monastery of the Great Lavra. He, like another Moses, ascended Athos as Moses ascended the mountain of Sinai, and there he entered into the mysteries of Athenite theology, as is shown afterward. If anyone wishes to find the events of this St. Athanasius the Athenite, he will read of them the day after tomorrow on the 5th of July, this coming Sunday exactly, and see who St. Athanasius the Athenite was. He was counted worthy to speak with the Theotokos and to bring forth water with his staff, water which still flows to this day, and so forth. Next in order comes St. Peter the Athenite, another person who likewise became an example for us. Our most holy Theotokos freed him from the prisons of Samara, where this man had been taken captive, and she showed him where he was to come. There also lived with him and near him another great father, St. Onufrios, whom you see depicted naked, covering with his beard his private parts and his nakedness in general, who went unshod there on the mountain where he lived. This event you will find on June 12th, if you read these details. Then there is St. Gregory Palamas, who was likewise connected with the Great Lavra. He is regarded as a great defender of the faith, and is greatly honored in Thessaloniki. The saint is the patron of Thessaloniki, forgive me. His relics are in the Metropolitan Cathedral of Thessaloniki, since the city's patron saint is Saint Demetrios of Thessaloniki. He was a serious theologian, and he waged a great struggle. In the beginning he was at the monastery of Esphigmenou as its abbot, and later he became a Lavriad, as is mentioned here. His holy relic, as it says at the end, is in the church of Thessaloniki that I am telling you of. The life of this saint is on the 14th of November. He struggled a great deal against the Latins. I don't know whether you're familiar with that whole affair. Through the intercession of the Theotokos, he was counted worthy by God of many gifts of grace, and above all of the gift of theology. And with that gift he contended for the right glory of God, for the true and orthodox teaching about him. The saint also took part in 3 great councils attended by great numbers of people under 3 emperors, Andronikos Palaiologos, John Kantakouzenos, and John Palaiologos, and under 3 patriarchs, John, Isidore, and Callistos, and he decisively defeated Barlaam and Echidnos and Gregorus and their followers, who were blaspheming against the divine energies of God, his uncreated activity. Later on, he became Archbishop of Thessaloniki, and when he fell asleep, he was granted a blessed end. God made the saint's tomb a fountain of miracles, and that tomb is venerated as well. At the Great Lavra, too, there was another venerable saint, Gregory the Byzantine. He, too, served as a teacher, the teacher of this divine Gregory, who had him as his master. He is the teacher par excellence in the Neptic philosophy of watchfulness. Also, another who belongs to the Lavra is Maximus, who is also called Kausokalevis, the hut burner, because he kept moving. And as he went from one place to another, he would burn down his hut. He flourished around the year 1320. He was above all the man of noetic prayer, a most exacting laborer at it. Having received from God not only the gift of clairvoyance, but also the gift of prophecy, he later died, as it says here. When his relics were translated, they gave forth a beautiful fragrance. We find him commemorated as a saint on January 13th. We now come to another man named Niphon, who was like Maximus in every respect. He too possessed spiritual gifts and lived in caves and in the depths of the earth around the year 1330 after Christ. His feast is celebrated on June 24, June. Within the same territory of the Lavra, Saint Nilos is also venerated. He too was a father of Nepsis, or watchfulness, and wrote extensively on noetic prayer. In the first volume of the Philokalia, you will be able to read many of his writings. Because of the purity of his life, myrrh flowed from his relics, and for this reason he is called the Myrrh Streamer. Go to the cemeteries and ask the gravediggers, what comes out when they exhume us? Rot and foul odor. But 30 to 40% come out differently. There are others, even today, who have been excommunicated, deniers of Christ and the faith. Yet all these, he says, became myrrh-streaming saints. Another is Akakios, who belonged to the Sket of Kafsokalevia. There, he says, he practiced ascesis together with others. Alongside him, it says, another like him struggled in asceticism, a monk martyr who was from Usakian of Philadelphia, from Turkey, a saint. His relic is found on Patmos at the monastery of John the Theologian. His feast is on the 21st of May, together with St. Constantine and Helen. Then there was yet another, Romanos the monk martyr, who came from Carpenisi, from here, and he was martyred in Constantinople in the year 1694. Then again, there was still another, Nicodemus from Albania, who received a staff from St. Akakios, and strengthened by it, completed his martyrdom in glory and manfully in his own homeland, at Elbasan in Albania in the year 1722. He is celebrated on April 12th, if you wish to find his life in detail. There was also at the Lavra a Damaskinos, a monk martyr. I do not know if you understand what a monk martyr means. A Hosios is a monk, and a martyr is one who bears witness in blood. We may have a martyr who is not a monk. Because he was not a monk, he was a layman. Then there is the virgin martyr, like Saint Paraskevi, holy, a virgin, and a martyr. She was a nun, she was a virgin, and she was a martyr. And Hosios means a monk. Damaskinos was from the monastic order, in case you do not follow, and that is why I tell you this. This Damaskinos at first denied his faith, but afterwards, having done 12 years of great obedience at the Lavra, he departed with Patriarch Dionysios, who was living at the Lavra, to Constantinople. There he confessed Christ boldly, and after suffering many torments he was beheaded in 1681, and his feast is kept on the 13th of November. If you read the accounts of all these holy men, all those who at first denied Christ and their faith and afterwards came back, every one of them was beheaded. Not one of them died a natural death. They gave their blood afterwards, believing that in this way they could wipe out their denial of the faith. I say this as a mirror and a counterweight to ourselves, who deny Christ not under fear of the Turk, of the Aga, but under the pull of money of gold, for many, as you know, deny Christ for the sake of gold. You see the Jehovah's Witnesses and the like, You see the Protestants with their checks and such things. It is a serious matter when someone coerces you and you lose heart and deny. But when no one coerces you at all and you still deny, the danger is great and the judgment is severe. Another such figure associated with the Lavra is the hieromartyr Constantine the Muscovite, who was either a simple monk or perhaps a priest. He came from Russia to Constantinople and afterward went to the Holy Mountain, where he lived at the Lavra because of the war then being fought between the Russians and the Muslims. When peace was restored, he returned to the imperial city, that is, Constantinople. There, the account goes on to say, he confessed the Orthodox faith, and since he refused to choose the religion of the Hagarenes, he was beheaded in front of the imperial palace. At the Great Lavra, there is also the man you yourselves will have heard of, the chanter John, known as Cucuzelis. He had been the chief chanter at the imperial palace in Constantinople. Later he left behind every honor and pleasure the imperial court could offer, and departed for the Lavra, where he arrived without revealing his identity. He pastured goats there, kids and billy goats. That was his work, and nobody knew who he was. They discovered him there when he chanted. The animals stopped grazing and stood there without eating, and so he became a monk. After that, he served as the goatherd for the monastery's goats. It became known later on that this was John Cucuzelis, the very man the emperor was searching for, and it came out through a certain hymn that he chanted with great artistry and sweetness in the stillness of that place where he was pasturing the goats. Because of this, he received permission and freedom from the emperor to remain undisturbed in the monastery through the mediation of the abbot, who interceded for him. So he built himself a cell outside the Lavra and the church of the archangels outside the monastery, and there he kept stillness, the quiet of Hezekiah, 6 days of the week. But on Sundays and feast days he would come into the monastery and chant with reverence in the right-hand choir. Now on one Saturday of the Akathist, after he had chanted the Troparia and the canons of the Theotokos with great care, he dozed off for a little while at the chanter's stand, right there where he was standing. And as though in a vision, the Lady Theotokos appears to him and says, "Rejoice, John, my child, chant to me, and I will never forsake you." She greeted him and said to him, "John, my child, chant, and I will not abandon you." When she had said this, she also placed a gold coin in his right hand, and through that coin many miracles were later worked by him. And afterwards this same Lady Theotokos healed this John again. When his foot had become gangrenous, she appeared to him and said, "From this moment on be well, for you saw a moment ago what she said, I will be your provider, your physician, and your nourisher." And so the physician she had promised to be went and healed his right foot. Living in this God-pleasing way, and having foreknowledge of his death, he reposed in the Lord and was buried at the cell of the archangels, just as he had directed. If anyone is interested, they will find his account on October 18th. There you can look up the account of it. Then there is yet another, St. Gregory the Domesticos. Of him this is told. While the Lord Jacob Preconis was abbot, on the eve of Theophany, he chanted at the Divine Liturgy, not the Axion Estin, but the In You Rejoices, and at the close of the all-night vigil, sleep came over him for a little while. Here, when I finish this, I'll tell you something, and behold, he sees Our Lady the Theotokos standing over him and saying, "Receive the chanter's pay, take the wage for your labor," and he accepted it and thanked her over and over. And the Panagia thanks him warmly. And when she had said this, she gave him with her own hand a gold florin, and that coin hangs to this day on the holy icon of the Theotokos. He was buried at the Great Lavra, and his grave is preserved there to this day. You can read about these events on the 10th of October. A small aside, you see here chanters and men of the spirit falling asleep in their stalls. I say this for their sake, and above all for certain mature Christians who condemn those who happen to doze off during an all-night vigil. Do you know that all the revelations and extraordinary miracles took place in moments such as these, when this weary body received them when the spirit was willing, but the flesh was weak? Do you know that it was at such a moment that the chanter Kukuzalus brought the most holy Theotokos down from heaven through his chanting, and she answered him? At one point, for example, while the other chanter was chanting, sleep overtook him right there. He did not go to bed. He stayed there at the chanter's stand, slumped over, almost falling from his chair, yet he would not get up and go home. He has a rich reward from God, but you must also take care of yourself. So if sleep overtook them a little in both these cases, don't think it strange. God sees a person struggle, and he condescends to their weaknesses. He comes down and meets us right where we are weak. And in both these cases, you see, the most holy Theotokos came at the very hour when they fell asleep. I do not know whether you have read that lovely and slightly amusing account of Saint Menas at a vigil one night. See what happened at his festival. Among the sick there was a lame woman, lame in one foot and a mute woman, and Saint Menas goes over to this mute woman, whom sleep had seized a little, and says to her, without her knowing, of course, that he was the saint walk on slowly, he tells her. And she took hold of his robe, and he goes along like a robot, so to speak, with no will of his own. And he grabs her by the skirt, and a commotion breaks out. She tries to protest. Who are you, you scoundrel, as we might say, coming up to me inside the church and grabbing me by the skirt? He is terrified by what has happened, and as he runs off, his legs are restored. She tries to speak with her hands, and her tongue is loosed. And so in this way the man walked and the woman spoke. Now what can you say to me about someone who works all day through the whole shift? And all week long he labors, and then he comes to keep the vigil. If sleep seizes him a little, nudge him. He is only a man. We are not going to pull out the pistol. Nor are you a saint yourself, for you sleep all day and then come at night and stay wide awake. This is what it shows here. I say this so that a few tongues may be spared, so that they may come out melted rather than unmelted. There is another beautiful account here from the Lavra about a venerable man named Gerontios. It says here that he was the last abbot of the monastery of the Boulouterian, and that he lived at St. Anna, thus avoiding the constant raids of the pirates, for the monastery suffered great attacks at their hands. For this reason, it says, he went up with a few brethren into the rocky heights, and they lived there where the skate of St. Anna stands today. Now St. Gerontios, who loved the precious gift of stillness, Hesychia, went up to the highest places of all, with none of his disciples going along with him, up to where the chapel of St. Panteleimon stands, and living there in holiness, purifying himself both by praxis, that is, ascetic practice, and by theoreia, the contemplation of God, and by prayer to the Theotokos, he saw again and again water welling up out of the ground like drops of sweat. He brought forth water in a place where there was none and where it was needed, and he passed over to the Lord full of days, it says. He is commemorated on the 9th of July. In the same monastery there is also a Dionysios the Rhetor, one of the hieromonks called the Stodite, as coming from some dependency in Constantinople of the monastery of Stodios, as you please. There is also another venerable one, Metrophanes. All of these are saints, one of the hieromonks and spiritual fathers, who was a disciple of this same divine Dionysios. There is also another, Sophronios, who received the priestly office, and who was like the blessed Alexios, the man of God. He lived that same kind of life, and so he came to the holy mountain and became a monk in the skete of St. Anna. He lived his life after the manner of the divine apostles, self-controlled, righteous, and devout, becoming for his fellow ascetics a type, a pattern, and example of good works. And there is yet another venerable martyr, a monk who died a martyr's death, St. Macarius, from Chios in Bithynia. That is where he came from, down in those parts. His father, having embraced impiety, was pressing his son toward the Hagarenes. Since he could not persuade him, it says, he himself circumcised him against his will. So the young man, coming secretly to the holy mountain, became a monk at the skate of St. Anna. This great struggler, after 12 years, went off to Prausa and confessed the true faith. Reviling the religion of the Hagarenes, he was given over to torments, and so, Over a span of 40 days, tortured in many ways yet remaining unshaken, he astonished everyone, even his apostate father, who took part in the punishments inflicted upon him. What did Christ mean by that? He divides father from child, the father set against his own child. We see it in the life of Saint Barbara as well, whose father himself asked to be the one to put his daughter to death for Christ. What a great longing for Christ! What a great inspiration! I came to bring a sword, he says, upon the earth. So don't think it strange if families are divided and married couples break apart for the sake of Christ. Don't think it strange. His own father, it says, took part in punishing him. And in the end, when he had been beheaded, a heavenly light was seen coming down from above upon his holy relics. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother, and so on. There are heaps of cases like these, as many as you could wish for. I've simply brought you a few as samples to show you what we're talking about. And other incidents took place as well, things that happened in the course of various miracles connected with the monasteries and with the icons of the Most Holy Theotokos. Time is passing, and I can't cover it all. I come now to a passage where it says that all these men, among the other virtues they possessed, had above all a deeply developed sense of hospitality. I don't know if you're aware of this, but a man could enter the Holy Mountain without a single penny. For however long you go about, you will eat and you will sleep, you have nothing to pay anywhere, not just one person, but 100, 200, 500 of them moving through. I don't know what would become of that today. What happens when you arrive? As soon as you get there, they immediately offer you a cold drink. Especially if it is summer, they at once bring you raki Turkish delight and a glass of water. Then the guest master brings you coffee. After that, they take you into the guest house, offer you a meal, and assign you a room that has been prepared so that you can go and rest. You may stay at the monastery as long as you wish and leave whenever you wish to continue on your way. This is a profound matter, yet they never became poor through giving. This is a great lesson for us. We have much and give nothing, while they have nothing and still have something to give. Something I read made a deep impression on me, and I will share it with you, because many of you may not have access to helpful books in which to find such accounts. Listen to this, and I will finish. In one monastery there was an abbot who was exceedingly hospitable and merciful. The more he gave alms to the poor, the more abundantly God blessed the monks of the monastery. But after that abbot died, after him came another abbot, but he was unmerciful and showed no mercy. From all those to whom he denied hospitality and almsgiving, the strangers and the poor, God in turn withheld his blessing from the monastery, and the monks tasted such hardship that they barely had their daily bread, only a dry crust was left to them. Now one day a holy and venerable elder came to one of the gatekeepers, and he asked him to let him into the monastery. The gatekeeper received him, but in secret, because the abbot was harsh. He received him but secretly, and then giving him hospitality in secret, he says to him, "Do not be surprised, good man, that I am not caring for you as I should." He asks the man's forgiveness because he has nothing with which to attend to him as is fitting and as he deserves. For once this monastery was so blessed that even if the bishop himself came, we would host him in abundance. But it has fallen into such misfortune that it cannot care even for the poorest man. Then the elder who had appeared answered him, "Two brothers were driven out of this monastery, and unless they return, this monastery will never prosper again." Now the gatekeeper is left wondering who these brothers are who were driven out. One is named Give, and the other It Shall Be Given, and when he had said this, he vanished. At once the gatekeeper reported the vision to the abbot and to all the brothers, so that they began once more to welcome strangers as they had before. And in this way the monastery began again to receive the offering and the blessing of prosperity. These men, who to all appearances have nothing, have so much to teach us from their lives, my brothers, and the commemoration of the saints is set before us for the remembrance and imitation of holiness.